The bad boy of gonzo journalism looks back on his own generation, the baby boom generation, and finds himself unable to keep a straight face. With us today on Uncommon Knowledge, the author of The Baby Boom, P.J. O'Rourke. Shooting from the campus of Dartmouth College, Uncommon Knowledge now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge, filming today at Dartmouth College. I'm Peter Robinson. Patrick Jake O'Rourke grew up in Toledo, Ohio, did his undergraduate work at Miami University in Ohio, earned a master's in English at Johns Hopkins in a program that he himself has described as, quote, a complete waste of time, close quote, and then became one of the inventors of gonzo journalism, writing for National Lampoon, Rolling Stone, and a dozen other publications. Mr. O'Rourke is the author of 16 books, including the classic Parliament of Whores and his most recent volume, The Baby Boom, How It Got That Way, and It Wasn't My Fault, and I Won't Do It Again. PJ, welcome.
Well, thank you.
Who they were, the baby boom generation, 75 million Americans born between 1946 and 1964, when after more than two decades of depression and war, Americans were once again able to start families, and when the United States represented the richest and most powerful nation in history, I'll quote from the baby boom, take the biggest generation in the most important country, put them in excessively happy families, give them too much affection, extravagant freedom, scant responsibility, plenty of money, a modicum of peace, if they dodged the draft, a profusion of opportunity, and a collapse of traditional moral standards, close quote. Well, take all that, PJ, and what do you get?
Gee, a lot of fun first. There was probably very few generations that have had as much fun, too much fun, of course, in some cases. It went down the John Belushi road, but we did have a tremendously good time. What you also get from that is, of course, a terrific social experiment, which is basically, what if you let a whole generation of people, a really sizable generation of people, pretty much do anything they want? What do you get? And I started out writing the book thinking, well, what you got was a bunch of self-absorbed jerks, really. And by the time I got done with the book, I realized that, no, actually, what you got was some really nice, self-involved, but really decent and surprisingly hardworking people doing, to a remarkable degree by world history standards, what they wanted to do in life. And it's pretty nice.
The baby boom was pretty nice. The book is to a large extent a memoir of your own boyhood,
well,
right?
No, actually not. Because what a memoir is how different I am from you. I was running with scissors. A memoir really sets the memoir writer apart from the rest of humanity. What I was trying to do was tap into collective memory. I tried to bring forth the memories from my childhood and my adolescence and post-adolescence that, well, maybe not all 75 million, but a large percentage of those 75 million baby boomers shared. I wanted to take a little yeast of my memory and put it in the bread dough of other people's memories. And the reaction I saw was, you know, not to show how different I was, but to show how much the same I was, and to get people to say, oh, I remember that, or I hadn't thought about that in years.
That was my reaction again and again. You and I are a few years apart, but still, there was a lot in there that rang very sweetly. So let me give you a quotation and ask you how you explain this lost world to your own kids. We're both in the same pickle. We both have teenagers. The baby boom. Our house had a single phone in the dining room, on a shelf, in a nook, specifically designed to accommodate it. People used to talk face to face in their own backyards over garden gates. Sometimes in the background, there'd be a clothesline. I can actually remember the clotheslines. There'd be a clothesline or a manually operated push lawnmower. Can you make your children believe it ever was?
The clothesline and the push lawnmower, I think they could get their heads around. The phone, no. The other day, my 10-year-old son was saying, because we have those portable phones, we've got three of them in the house, and nobody ever puts them back in their little cradle to recharge.
Right, of course.
And the phone was ringing somewhere, you know, and nobody could figure out where a phone was. And Cliff said, why don't we tie a string to the base of the phone and tie the other end of the string to the phone, and that way we would never lose it. And I thought, yeah, why not? Maybe a big, long, stretchy one.
Once again, the baby boom. We in the baby boom were lucky. Children had once been put to work, if not in factories and farmyards, then in the kitchen, cellars, and sculleries of their own homes. And now children have been put to work again. Homework started coming home with my children, writing of your own children,
yeah,
in kindergarten. Baby boomers were excused. We were only expected to clear our plates.
Yeah. And we'd usually,
but you're actually making an important point there. This was, in some ways, a unique, taking the long sweep of human history, we were uniquely gifted. There was a unique, almost uniquely golden moment for kids to be a kid.
It really was. I mean, enough labor-saving household appliances had come into play that children were no longer dragooned into hanging things out on those clotheslines. Mom had a dryer. But also the household labor-saving devices were just a little more complex and heavyweight to let the kids use.
Right.
So I, for instance, or my sisters, I mean, we were never made to vacuum.
Because, those were huge,
difficult machines. 60 pounds,
right,
you know?
Right.
I mean, we couldn't maneuver that thing around. And so there was, you know, that's part of it. And part of it was just our parents' attitude. They'd had a rough time in the Depression. They'd had a rough time in the war. And they didn't want to see us have a rough time. I remember my mother telling me when I was about my son's age. She said, you know, I was always made to eat all sorts of things I didn't like. I hated liver. And she said, I promised myself when I was a little kid, when I had kids, I would never make them eat stuff they didn't want. And she didn't.
And she
didn't. And she didn't. And, to, you know, and I didn't discover Brussels sprouts until about 6 months ago.
So here's the question. Well, I want to come in a moment to the world that baby boomers began to create. But first, the America that their grandparents and parents created for them. And you want to maintain that although these days it tends to be derided as a bland, nothing accomplished, unimportant period, John Kennedy, let's get America moving again, implies that America was just stagnant during the 50s. You want to argue that that actually represented, that moment represented an American achievement. Our grandparents and parents built something worth building.
It was huge. If we just take the economic facts, leaving aside what was going on in society, the baby boom growing up from the late 40s, really until the Arab oil embargo, we had $10,000 more per year in median family income. Not average, because that can be skewed by top and bottom, but half above, half below median. $10,000 more than the greatest generation had growing up. It's a lot of money. And not only that, but if you look at economic measures from the period when the greatest generation was growing up, and you look at economic
greatest generation being our parents.
Being our
parents. The world, the ones who fought during the war.
Yeah, the ones who went through the Depression, who said childhood depression, not as we know it now, as it actually was, and fought in the war and all had babies at the same time. If you look at their childhood, the economy goes severely down, brief but severe recession after World War I, soars in the 20s to 1929, drops back precipitously to the bottom of the Depression, and only begins to ramp up when we're rearming before World War II. And so not only did we have more money growing up than our parents did, but we had a kind of economic stability. If you look at the economic growth from 46 till the Arab oil embargo, it is pretty much a steady ramp up. I mean, Kennedy, when he's talking about getting America moving again, was responding to a very minor recession at the end of the 50s. It barely shows as a blip on a graph. I mean, nothing compared to what we went through in 2008, 2009. Nothing even compared to when the dot-com bubble popped.
So our parents, the greatest generation, endured the Depression, went off and fought the war, came home, and gave us this golden moment in which to grow up. Now let's turn to what we did with it. The baby boom. Quote, there was the Vietnam War. We had decided war was wrong, and prominent moralists such as Peter, Paul, and Mary agreed. And there was us. Peace, violence, civil rights, looting, and arson. Protests loud enough to deafen the nation to everything being shouted. Political fantasies so beautiful they made reality get ugly. You are a humorist, and there's not a paragraph in that book that's not funny, but that is also angry. So how did the sweetness of the 50s turn into the ugliness of the 60s?
Well, I think it was a tantrum, really, that my generation, our generation, threw. We grew up in not a perfect world, of course, but we were sort of given the perception that if it was perfect or where it was imperfect, it was improving. It was stable, it was quiet. Of course, it wasn't perfectly quiet. There were things like the Korean War, but almost all of us too young to remember that. Something like the revolution in Hungary and being crushed by Soviet tanks is, very vague.
I mean, right. It took place a long way away, and televisions were small and in black and white in those days.
Right, and we were very young. And then when we arrived at the 60s, and first and foremost was we were just having a big party. We discovered sex and drugs and rock and roll. And they decided to call all the guys away from the party and give them haircuts and make them do push-ups. We were mad. But we'd also discovered, even before the Vietnam War became really prominent in people's minds, we had discovered that America was racist, that there was a lot of economic injustice in America, that America was not the perfect or becoming perfect place that we had thought it was. And we sort of threw a fit. We basically lay down, we did a kind of teenage version of laying down on the floor and kicking our feet, and beating on the carpet with our hands. And it was a kind of a disappointment. And it did turn ugly. What's most amazing, though, given historical turns of ugliness in society, is that ugliness didn't last very long, really. It happens between the late 60s and very early 70s, and then disco.
So is there an element almost of a Greek tragedy here? Our parents suffer and struggle to give us this perfect world, and we take it and rip it apart.
No, actually, I don't think so. I think that what happened was that our parents came through the Depression and the war and various other things that were going on, themselves deeply disillusioned. They understood sex. When guys were going off to war, let's not think of our parents as being L7 about this, I mean, there were many passionate partings. They understood, they didn't understand drugs, but they understood one drug, alcohol, so well that it kind of counts for every other. Makes up for the difference. You can't have gone through the first half of the 20th century and not have been at least a little disillusioned about organized religion and maybe even the nature of God. They weren't ready to express this publicly, but they had to be. Some very dark books come out of the Greatest Generation. Catch 22 on the funny side, Naked and the Dead on the not so funny side. There was a lot of anxiety in our parents, man in the gray flannel suit, that kind of thing. And what we were able to do because of the stability of society and the wealth of society and the permissiveness of us, of our parents, we were able to act out a lot of things that they felt. And some of the things they felt were subconscious, and they were pretty disturbed when we began acting them out. And also, one of the great reasons for dinner table fights and screaming matches during the 60s was that there's nothing more frustrating than watching somebody do and say the kind of things you've wanted to do and say, but haven't had the opportunity or maybe the nerve to do and say. Really infuriating. And that was part of the reason that parents were so angry during part of the 60s. But really, you know, by the time the early 70s had rolled around, our parents had in many ways come around to see things from our point of view.
Summary statement here. The baby boom, I'm quoting the baby boom again. Baby boomers, this is you summing things up at the end of the book, baby boomers are better people. Well, not better. We're a lot like Lord Byron. Explain the reference to Lord Byron.
Well, Lord Byron was somebody who, due to his social class and his talent and some family money, was allowed to do pretty much whatever he wanted. And a lot of that stuff was not so attractive. On the other hand, he also had an opportunity to express his genius. He had a lot more genius than the average or maybe even any member of the baby boom. But nonetheless, he got a chance to express it, as we got a chance to express what modest genius we have. And so he left kind of a mess behind him, but he also left a sort of body of work. And then Byron was, you know, maybe a bit of a romantic, but a good-hearted guy. I mean, he died fighting for the independence of Greece. Well, actually, he died of diarrhea, but on his way to fight for the independence. But let's not
had Pepto-Bismol been invented, he would have fought for the independence of Greece.
Right.
One final passage from the Baby Boom that operates, I think, as a bridge to your classic Parliament of Horrors. It's your political awakening. You write about an early job, paid $75 a week. You got a paycheck every 2 weeks for $150. You said you looked forward to that paycheck, and so did your landlord. And then you got it. Quote, when I got my paycheck, I found that I netted not $150, but $82.27 after federal income tax, state income tax, city income tax, Social Security, union dues, and pension fund contribution. I was a communist. I had protested for communism. I had rioted for communism. Then I got a capitalist job and found that we had communism already.
That is very much what happened to me. And that was the first gong that went off in my... Actually, you know, it wasn't the first gong that went off in my mind. It was the Weather Underground that really began to turn me in a different political direction. When the when they blew up the townhouse in trying to make bombs, which they were going
Philadelphia, as I recall?
No, this was Greenwich Village.
Greenwich Village, yeah. Right.
And it was must have been 19. I'm going to say 71. We could Google this. And they were going to use those bombs, shrapnel bombs, to attack a dance for servicemen and their girlfriends and wives, I think at Fort Meade in New Jersey. And I thought, gee, this we can do anything stuff has its limits. Also, my high school girlfriend, who was a year behind me in school, was at Kent State after I got over the huge indignation of her being shot at, and of course some of the kids at Kent being killed, I began to realize that Kent was kind of working class college, and a lot of the guys there were there to stay out of the draft and kind of came from blue collar backgrounds. Ohio National Guard, there's a lot of guys who came from blue collar backgrounds, and they were in the National Guard to stay out of the draft, and that we had shot ourselves. That this was not like some sort of social divide. This was two very similar groups of people. And yes, the violence began to erupt toward the end of the period of demonstrations, began to make me queasy.
All right. Parliament of Horrors, shifting now to that book, which is on politics. Introductory statement. Conservatism. You're writing about Washington. You're writing about Washington in that book as an observer.
Yeah.
That is to say, you are there as a reporter.
Right.
But you explain at the outset, there's a disclaimer, I write from a certain point of view and it's conservative. Conservatism relies upon personal responsibility and promotes liberty, private liberty. It is an ideology of individuals. Everyone with any sense and experience in life would rather take his fellows one by one than in a crowd. Explain that, PJ.
A mob. Usually, not always, of course, but usually you can deal with people on a one-to-one basis. When people get a mob mentality, there's no dealing with them at all. And I have always felt that people who wanted more community, larger government, greater unity, a lot of the bumper stickers we see right here in Hanover, are actually asking for trouble. I don't think they mean to, but they're asking for a kind of fascistic community that all works together. And that's fine as long as they're working together to start a food co-op, but when they're working together to you know, hang somebody who's in jail, not so much so. And of course, that mob can turn in any direction. I fear government not in a sort of Tea Party way. I just fear it on a quantitative basis. I mean, if you put together federal, state, and local spending, you get very close to 40% of GDP. That is an awful lot of control to turn over to what we know to be a highly flawed political process. And of course, private processes, capitalism and so forth, are highly flawed too, but they're flawed one by one, whereas the government is all flawed together. And government, unlike private enterprise of any kind, profit or nonprofit, government has a legal monopoly on deadly force. So, you know, you don't pay that traffic ticket, you get fined. You don't pay the fine, you go to jail.
You don't buy health insurance under the individual mandate.
Yeah, there
is coercion behind this.
Yes, and you know, if you try to escape from jail, they shoot you. Right. So you can get shot for a traffic ticket, you know.
The Parliament of Horrors, another quotation. The federal government of the United States takes away between a fifth and a quarter of our money every year. That is double the tithe of the medieval church and twice the royal tribute that the prophet Samuel warned the Israelites against when they wanted to anoint him a ruler. Our government gets more than thugs in a protection racket. How did this happen? You and I met in Washington through Andy Ferguson, our friend, in the 80s. You write Parliament of Horrors in the 90s. You write about the individualism of the baby boom generation, how they want what they are, want, and they are what they are, and are interested in self-expression, strong strain of individualism. And yet between the time that you and I met in Washington, it is as if Ronald Reagan had never been born.
That's right.
Why?
This is a paradox that, unfortunately, I was not able to come up with an answer. looking at the baby boom, their experience and their behavior, you would expect them to be not necessarily Republican, because they're not socially conservative enough for the Republican Party, but you would expect them to be strongly libertarian.
Yes.
And they do have little libertarian streaks and a few libertarian things run through their thinking, gay marriage and legalization of marijuana, for to give two examples. But they also have a peculiar love of the political process, and hence if not a trust in government, a willingness to let government do things. And I think it doesn't have anything to do with particular kind of politics, because if we take the three baby boomer presidents that we've had so far, Bill Clinton and George W. Bush and Barack Obama, and we map them out politically, you have to go to Pyongyang to find somebody more different from them politically than they are from each other. It's that we just like politics itself. One thing is because it's easy. It has a low bar of entry. All you have to be is sort of full of baloney and shake a lot of hands, you know? And it doesn't really require a skill. It's not like going to medical school or even law school. You know, you can just kind of step into politics. And our generation does love that kind of interaction with people. We love that kind of argument, that we love that kind of BS that is at the core of politics. And so we have wound up to be a very political generation, and I don't mean that in any partisan way. It's just simply overall.
We like the game.
We like the game. We really like the game. And all you have to do is go to a zoning board or a co-op committee meeting or something.
Okay, so this leads me to your brilliant, by the way, Parliament of Horrors, which is now, what was the pub date, Peter? 93, 94?
Because I was writing the acknowledgments over in Saudi Arabia during the run-up for the first Gulf War. So it must have been published in 92. Yeah.
So it's over two decades old. It remains, I will say, it is the best book on Washington that I have ever read. And I've read a lot of them.
Thank you.
So here's the closing scene is P.J. O'Rourke in his now hometown, still your hometown of Sharon, well, your new home, your family's hometown of Sharon, New Hampshire, and you attend.
So it was actually Jaffrey. I lived in the next town.
Jaffrey, excuse me. Okay, I'm sorry. And you attend one of these storied, this picture of democracy, a town meeting.
Yeah.
And you write about how the town meeting has the advantage that you get up and talk to your neighbors face to face, but to you, the astounding disadvantage that everybody's still trying to take or cut a deal or rip off his neighbors in one way or another.
The dynamic turns out for a town meeting, Norman Rockwell illustrations aside, the dynamic at a town meeting turns out to be exactly the same as the dynamic in Washington. It may not divide along party lines, it may divide along something like whether there's going to be a gravel pit, but exactly the same political dynamic. And that was, of course, is my conclusion to the Parliament of Horrors.
So let me read that conclusion.
Sure.
Authority has always attracted the lowest elements in the human race, those who lord it over their fellows and toss commands in every direction and would boss the grass in the meadow about which way to bend in the wind, are the most depraved kind of prostitutes. They will submit to any indignity, perform any vile act, do anything to achieve power. Every government is a parliament of whores. The trouble is, in a democracy, the whores are us. That's beautiful writing, brilliantly insightful, and tragic.
And tragic.
You really do mean to argue that there's no way out. That even in the American experiment, even in this great blessed republic, there's no way out. Politics is just going to cause government to expand and expand.
Well, you know, it has its limits. All curves are, I remember years ago talking to a friend of mine who was a mathematician. And I was saying to the, you know, as we all do all the time, if things keep going like they are today, you know, I forget about what. And he said, all curves are self-limiting. And that curve, too, is self-limiting. We have to learn to, you know, I think Ronald Reagan was trying to teach us a lesson. Somebody else will come along, I hope, and do so too. We have to learn to limit government, not because of some ideological reason, but simply you can't task the government with everything and expect everything to be well done. It would be like tasking one's wife with both raising her kids and making a living and cleaning a house and doing all the carpooling and while you sat on the couch and drank beer.
You sound like a man who's tried.
Oh gosh, yes. With some success, I may say. But nonetheless, you know, it has its limits.
It has its limits.
Yeah, sooner or later, she's going to hit you with a piece of firewood. The government isn't going to do that, but it's just going to fail if we overburden it. And unfortunately, I fear that some sort of crisis on it, not a crisis, civil war crisis, but a crisis on the order of Greece will be required for us to really fix this thing.
Couple of last questions, PJ. One is the good life. Baby boom generation, your generation and mine, the Cold War was still going on. You're enough older so that Vietnam was a live issue for you in a way that it wasn't for me. But on college campuses, I can recall on this campus, politics mattered. We talked politics at least in part because it mattered.
It mattered a great deal. Matter of life and death for some members of the baby boom.
Exactly so. Now we come to the millennial generation, the kids who are students here now. Your oldest is 16, off to college in a couple of years.
That's right.
And what do they see in Washington? Dysfunction, absurd debates. And I live in Northern California now where it is very much in the air. Don't even bother with politics. It's unfixable. Just don't waste your time. Devote your energies to the private sector. It's a libertarian position. Start a company. Drop out. But don't do acid. Start a company.
Right. Or a charity.
So what would you say? What would your advice be to the millennials? You do.
I think it's absolutely good. I'm glad to see them not loving the game the way that we did. Arguably, they don't have to, but it's a shift in attitude. They're highly skeptical of politics and not terribly interested in politics, and we should all be.
We should all be that.
Yeah. I remember going around China with a friend of mine who's owned some steel foundries and pelletized iron ore plant, and he's an American, but he lives in Hong Kong. Anyway, we're wandering around mainland China, and I said, you know, I haven't heard any political discussion. Is it because people are afraid to talk about politics? And he said, no, they're not afraid to. You get them started, they'll go going. But he said, you got to understand that the fundamental Chinese attitude toward government is, don't wake it up when it's sleeping. And I think our millennials have a little bit of that same attitude. Fortunately, what they would wake up would not be as terrifying as what...
It's a cultural revolution.
Yeah.
PJ, will you close the program by reading some of your own prose?
Well, sure, if I can find my glasses.
From the Parliament of Horrors. You write, I have only one firm belief about the American political system, and that it is this. God is a Republican and Santa Claus is a Democrat.
God is an elderly, or at any rate, middle-aged male, a stern fellow, patriarchal rather than paternal, and a great believer in rules and regulations. He holds men strictly accountable for their actions. God is difficult. God is unsentimental. It is very hard to get into God's heavenly country club. Santa Claus is another matter. He's cute, he's non-threatening, he's always cheerful. He may know who's been naughty and who's been nice, but he never does anything about it. He gives everyone everything they want without thought of a quid pro quo. Santa Claus is preferable to God in every way but one. There is no such thing as Santa Claus.
PJ O'Rourke, author of the classic Parliament of Horrors and most recently of The Baby Boom, thank you.
You're welcome.
At Dartmouth College, for the Hoover Institution and the Wall Street Journal, I'm Peter Robinson.